were babies, Craig.
We were babies, for sure.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And... good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. You can see that one of our colleagues is zooming in, and he is unable to see the timer. And so if you still are arguing and there are 2 minutes left and he hasn't asked a question, I may interrupt you and ask if Judge Sleater has any questions. And Madam Marshall, will you please call the case?
Sure. Our last case for this morning, A221707, 681 Properties, LLP versus Numerenius Wilcozzi.
And I know you both are familiar with the rules of the Court of Appeals, so please state your name and the party that you represent before you start arguing. You each will have 15 minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant. And once you've gotten settled and feel ready, you can begin. And there's a toggle in the middle of the podium.
Couldn't have been that tall, right?
He wasn't.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christopher Kalla. I represent the appellant, 681 Properties, LLP, the plaintiff in the underlying action. This appeal comes from a bench trial of a residential eviction case from Hennepin County. The appellant, my client, is the landlord. Respondent is the tenant. And that's how I will refer to them throughout the case. The facts of this case are fairly straightforward. The landlord received a notice from the local police department that a sexual assault had occurred at one of its apartments. The tenant was charged with felony fifth-degree sexual assault. The local police department directed the landlord to evict the tenant. An expedited eviction was filed, a summons was issued, and the case proceeded to trial. I'll note that local law enforcement and the county attorney's office was unassisting in providing my office with the necessary evidence to prosecute the case more fully. We were not given the name of the victim. We were not given the police report. Nonetheless, we did have a copy of the criminal complaint that was filed. That was offered as Exhibit B. That was rejected. The allegations of the assault violate the drug-free, criminal-free addendum that is attached to the lease, Exhibit A, page 9, specifically paragraphs 2, 3, and 5. The evidence in this case is not non-existent. There is some evidence. One, the tenant did live at the apartment where the assault was alleged to have occurred. This is admitted at page 10 of the transcript at lines 20 to 22. It's also paragraph 1 of the complaint, which is acknowledged as being admitted at page 5 of the transcript, lines 19 and 20. The location where the alleged assault was to have occurred was admitted. That's in the transcript at page 10, lines 23 through 25. The tenant was charged with the assault. That is Exhibit B, also acknowledged at the transcript, page 8, lines 1 through 9. There is evidence indicating that what we allege to have occurred did occur. The record isn't silent on that issue. The two legal issues for the court today is one.
So
yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Kalla, what is the evidence in the record that it occurred? Well, I'll stop there. Is it just the complaint? Well, the complaint wasn't admitted, so was there any other evidence? Because the case law in Peek v. Handicap says, such adverse inference can only be drawn when independent evidence exists of the fact to which the party refuses to answer. And I can appreciate, you know, your comments that, you know, you didn't get any help from the police department. But it seems like, you know, the only evidence I saw on the record that might have helped you was the complaint, which wasn't admitted because it, you know, and the case law is pretty clear that statements in a complaint are hearsay, State v. Wright, 719 Northwest 2nd, 910. So there's got to be some independent evidence. So what was the independent evidence that gets you to get the court to give the adverse inference instruction.
Sure. So I'll back up a little bit. I think the Peak case, I guess it's unreported, but it does indicate that things such as complaints are the type of evidence.
Well, Judge Willis wrote it, and I always thought he knew what he was doing. So,
but that's not what happened here. As I understand it, at trial, the tenant filed a motion in limine to keep the criminal complaint out. And at trial, your argument in opposition to that motion was limited to the assertion that you, the landlord, was not seeking to admit the complaint, I'm quoting here, for the substantive purpose of demonstrating that the allegations contained in the document are true, end quote, and instead argued that the document provided, quote, a good faith basis for the question that the landlord was about to ask the tenant and provided some context. So that was, as I understand it, the basis for your opposition to the tenant's motion in limine.
I appreciate the respondent's position that that statement undercuts my position today. And in hindsight, I think I would have phrased it differently.
So the record, you didn't argue that there were hearsay exceptions or other evidentiary rules that would apply to make that criminal complaint admissible.
At one point, I believe I did. I talked about the reliability of the police report. That may have been in the closing. The point.
But that was police reports, which also didn't come in.
I didn't have any police reports to offer.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That was the main point of offering that. Because I believe I didn't need to actually have that in the record to support the finding of an adverse inference. And actually, that is not inconsistent with the closing argument that tenants' counsel provides. At page 24 of the transcript, Mr. Prentice says, in addition to that, you know, Your Honor, you are permitted to draw an adverse inference. Mr. Kahl is setting up this up as if it's the only explanation for what Mr. Mulakazi would testify in the way that he did by exercising his right to remain silent. I understood the adverse inference could be drawn simply from asking the questions. I mean, this isn't coming out of thin air. There's a basis to ask those questions. It's not like we're picking somebody off the street, bringing him into court, and asking him all kinds of questions, and he pleads the fifth. There is a basis to ask those questions.
So this is the problem I have with your argument, and the problem is that the judge acknowledged that there could be adverse inferences. But it's discretionary. It's an evidentiary ruling by the district court judge. And so if Mr. Prentice were here saying the judge shouldn't have allowed adverse inferences, let's say it went the other way, the standard's the same. Did the judge abuse the judge's discretion in making that ruling? And so that's a very high bar when we review evidentiary rulings by a district court judge.
I appreciate that. And I was at a CLE a few years ago when Judge Morrow had a survey of how many cases of appeal were reversed on evidentiary issues, and I think it was out of 10,000 cases, maybe 40. It,
yes.
It's low. I get that.
Yeah.
But I would cite to the Baxter case at page 319 and 1558, citing the Todd case, quote, silence is often evidence of the most persuasive character. And they cite the Hale case, quote, failure to contest an assertion is considered evidence of acquiescence if it would have been natural under the circumstances to object to the assertion in question. And the assertion are those several questions that I asked Mr. Mulakazi. Did somebody visit your apartment at that time? Did you sexually assault somebody in your apartment that afternoon at your apartment, sir? On page 3, I have those six questions. Mr. Prentice's suggestion at his closing is that Mr. Kahla is setting this up as if that's the only explanation for why Mr. Mulakazi would testify in the way that he did. The best defense... Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it true, though, that the assertion needs to be the evidentiary assertion, not just simply for an adverse inference to even come to the forefront? In other words, let's assume the complaint had been received, or you got a police report, and it was submitted and accepted as part of evidence, then there's an assertion made for which he remains silent. Isn't that referring to, because simply asking a question or even having a complaint is not an evidentiary assertion at trial. Am I wrong?
I don't know that you're wrong, but I would have to review the context that the Baxter case cited Hale and Todd to answer that more specifically. But I would get back to one of the other issues, and that is the allegations in the complaint, the tenant never actually denied them. His attorney did, but he never did. I mean, we don't let attorneys vouch for their clients. When I receive complaints and I need to file answers, I consult my client regarding the factual allegations. At some point, I presume that's what happened. I'm not getting into an attorney-client privilege issue here, but there's no denial from the tenant as to any of those key questions.
Well, the judge found a finding of fact 4, tenant did not file a written answer, but appeared at the initial hearing and denied landlord's allegations. And you're saying it was the attorney who denied it, not
yes.
the client.
Yeah, Mr. Mulakazi never denied any of the allegations that would be most likely to be denied if he were to be compelled to give an answer. And we can query whether or not a negative answer to those questions would be perjury. That's not really the issue. But we can presume that not answering based on the Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination would be an adverse inference.
Except the judge used the judge's discretion to say in making an evidentiary ruling that the judge wasn't going to make that inference.
And I believe that would be an abuse of discretion per the Baxter case. Silence is often evidence of the most persuasive character. I'm not asking for the nature of the conversation he had with the other person in the apartment. I'm not asking for an explanation for why he did what he is alleged to have done. I'm simply asking, did you sexually assault somebody?
Well, we don't even know what those allegations are because they weren't introduced into evidence at trial.
Well, then that would be error from the court to not do that. I mean, they can take judicial notice of the criminal complaint that's filed.
They can, but they didn't.
Well, again, that would be error as well.
Did you ask them to take judicial notice, or did you just move to admit the complaint?
I didn't specifically ask the court to take judicial notice, but the court doesn't need my prompting to do that. I mean,
but that's not an issue that's been preserved for appeal then.
I think when the court declined to receive that document because it was hearsay upon hearsay and then gets into its...
But that wasn't your argument to the district court. Your argument to the district court was that you wanted it admitted for context for the questions you were going to ask the tenant.
That was the stated purpose, correct.
Mr. Kelly, if this had been let's say for the sake of argument, you can have jury trials in landlord-tenant cases. I know you can't.
Yeah, actually, you can.
Not for this one, but let's say, well, fine, then.
Rent escrow cases?
Even if the judge had given an adverse instruction, or the instruction on the adverse inference, the jury still could have found that you didn't prove your case by a preponderance of the evidence, and that wouldn't be error, correct?
We would have to look to see what the instruction said.
The exact one you want. I mean, you may draw an adverse inference from the defendant's invocation of the Fifth Amendment as to whether or not he breached the lease, okay? So that's the instruction. The jury hears it. They listen to the evidence, and they find for Mr. Prentice's client. I mean...
It's definitely a higher bar, but there's a body of case law, and I don't have the case right off the top of my head, but the quote, and I'll paraphrase, is... A judge and a jury may not disregard the unimpeached evidence that's unambiguous presented to them. If the only evidence that's presented, and Baxter suggests silence is evidence that's most persuasive character, if that's the only evidence that's in there, the scale is conclusively tipped in favor of the landlord. And so if a jury were to disregard and not find an adverse inference, keep in mind, because he's not testifying in the negative, his credibility on those issues isn't up for discussion. It's not up for consideration. The only evidence the jury would have, according to Baxter, is his silence. And that can only lead to one conclusion. As Mr. Prentice suggests, the court may draw an adverse inference. This court chose not to, based off of what they believe the law is. I appreciate that. But I think that is inconsistent with how the case is being presented now, that the court cannot draw an adverse inference because there isn't any extraneous or independent probative evidence to support the adverse inference. I think the defendant is also taking an inconsistent position from the trial into the appeal.
And Judge Slater can't see the time clock, so
30 seconds, Your Honor.
I'm going to ask him if he has any questions before you sit down. Judge Slater?
No additional questions. Thank you, Judge Rodney.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Keller.
Ready? Good morning. My name is Justin Prentice. I am the attorney for the respondent in this case. I'll keep the landlord-tenant terminology to make things simple. Before I get into what I had planned to speak about, I'd like to touch a little bit on what Mr. Kahlo was just arguing. It sounds to me like what he's arguing is that an adverse inference that could be drawn necessarily supports a finding that a plaintiff has sustained their burden of proof. He's saying that the district court needed to draw an adverse inference here and that that adverse inference must show, as a matter of law, that the facts have been proven. I think our Supreme Court case law undercuts that argument. Commissioner v. Fort specifically states that an adverse inference alone cannot support the burden to prove. With that, I'm going to briefly turn to the question of whether or not there was a genuine issue of material fact in this case. I disagree with Mr. Kahlo's characterization that my client never entered a denial of the allegations in the complaint. It actually happened twice. First, at the initial appearance in housing court, my client denied the allegations in the complaint generally, and we set it for a trial. There's a scheduling order in the record that reflects that. And then additionally, just before trial, after an off-the-record discussion between counsel, Mr. Kahlo returned to the court and specifically indicated that my client was disputing the two, more relevant allegations in this complaint. So there was a denial. To the extent that there's an argument that the district court should have sua sponte granted summary judgment, I don't think that's appropriately before the court here. I think Thiel v. Stitch would establish that given that that issue was never raised below, it's not preserved for appeal, and it would be inappropriate to reverse the district court on that basis.
On the first issue, Mr. Prentice, so like what, at the first appearance, the lawyer stood up, I guess it was you, and said we deny the allegations and request a trial? Was it something like that?
Essentially, yes. That would be allowed under Minnesota Rules of General Practice 607, which is the chapter of the Rules of General Practice that specifically apply to housing court in Hennepin and Ramsey County. Moving on to, I guess, what maybe is more the meat of this appeal is how I view it is, did the district court appropriately consider the evidence in the record? So if we look at the evidence in the record and the district court's factual finding that the plaintiff failed to prove their burden beyond of a preponderance of the evidence, I don't think that that finding is clearly erroneous. Essentially, all that there is in the record is questioning to my client, to which he remained silent. There is no other independent admissible evidence in the record. To the extent that there is evidence that he lives in his apartment, of course he does. This is an eviction case. So he wouldn't be fighting an eviction case at an apartment that he doesn't live in.
I spent a little bit of time contemplating the judge's footnote.
Mm-hmm.
Footnote number one on page 3 of the order. The complaint, criminal complaint filed against tenant was not admitted into evidence after objection. However, even if it had been admitted, the probable cause standard used for a criminal complaint is a lower standard than preponderance of evidence. And therefore, the criminal complaint on its own does not mean that the landlord has met their burden of proof. I hadn't ever seen those two burdens of proof, if you can call probable cause a burden of proof, compared that way.
Right. You know, how I read that footnote is essentially demonstrating that the separate evidentiary issue that we have before us, whether or not the district court erred in excluding the criminal complaint, even if that were error, which I don't believe that it is, would there be any prejudice to the plaintiff if that document would have come in? And I think what the district court order shows is that that error, if it were to have occurred, was not prejudicial, and that would be a basis to affirm on that issue. And I discussed that briefly in my brief as well.
If that was the case, wouldn't that make the adverse inference at least a stronger argument and more give the judge more pause, because now you have affirmative evidence of an allegation, albeit a lower level, of which then he remained silent. Now you got something to respond in a silent way, which is what the adverse inference is all about.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'll say at first, you know, the complaint needs to be admissible. I mean, evidence needs to be admissible to be received into evidence. So the complaint was not admissible here. It was rife with hearsay statements and hearsay within hearsay, and the judge recognized that.
Isn't that the point of the footnote that Judge Riley's referring to, and part of why, even in the criminal realm, the complaint itself doesn't mean you get past the Florence hearing on a probable cause, and so you have other evidence, but it is that nevertheless what we call based on probable cause, so it is evidence, and albeit that there inherently will have hearsay in it, but it's also a public document. Do you agree that if Mr. Callahan asked for judicial notice, the court could properly take notice of that complaint?
I would have objected to that if the criminal complaint was being used as substantive probative evidence of the allegations in the complaint, because the criminal complaint, and I don't believe that it's in the record, so I don't believe it's in front of your honors, but it essentially was only hearsay within hearsay statements. And, you know, what I find interesting is that the case law discusses having this adverse inference being drawn because it prevents unfair prejudice to the party that's seeking to establish that inference. Well, I'm of the opinion that it would be an unfair advantage to be able to bootstrap in hearsay within hearsay statements to establish a fact when those statements can't be tested for their credibility. And I think that that's why the case law, both Baxter, Fort, and then this Peak case, which again, reiterate this non-precedential, establishes that there needs to be some evidence, some independent, admissible, probative evidence established in the record to support the adverse inference to be drawn.
On that note, Mr. Prentice, I'd like you to consider this hypothetical. Let's say, for the sake of argument, Mr. Calla was able to get a police officer to testify, and the police officer said, I interviewed the victim in this case, and she was very excited at the time, and she said that your client raped me. Is that sufficient independent evidence such that an adverse inference could have been given in this case?
Potentially, sure. I mean, it's not what happened here. What you're describing to me right now sounds like statements of a third party, hearsay statements that would be potentially admissible under a hearsay exception. And those statements potentially could be used, you know, independent, probative, admissible evidence to support the district court drawing an adverse inference. But that's not what happened here. There is none of that. There's no police testimony. There's no neighbor testifying about a commotion that they heard next door, right? There's no cameras. There's no police report. There's really a lack of evidence entirely in the record. But I would take a step back, and to the extent that I'm hearing that there's an argument that my position is inconsistent with what I argued in closing arguments to the district court, a significant portion of the brief that I wrote was in response to this idea that the district court rejected an adverse inference. And I believe that the case law suggests that what we're talking about now, which is that there needs to be some other evidence to support the adverse inference, would lead to the conclusion that it was entirely appropriate, if not required, for the district court to reject an adverse inference. But if the court reads the district court's order, I don't see anywhere in the order where the district court states, I am rejecting an adverse inference. There's a discussion in paragraph 11 about case law surrounding that an adverse inference can be drawn and potentially what weight it can be given and whether the adverse inference alone is sufficient to sustain a burden. Then there's paragraph 12, that there is no witness testimony or admissible evidence to support the allegations. That finding is not clearly erroneous. There was no witness testimony or admissible evidence presented. And then there's a finding that the plaintiff failed to sustain their burden of proof. So I think that this order could be read to suggest that the district court did consider the fact that my client remained silent, recognized that an inference could be drawn, and still concluded that that evidence in the record was not sufficient to sustain the burden of proof.
You know, there doesn't seem to be any independent evidence to support that inference, I'll just tell you.
Fair enough. So, with regards to the admissibility of the criminal complaint, the standard of review here is an abuse of discretion. The statements were excluded on the basis of hearsay. The plaintiff landlord in their appellate brief suggests that the complaint could have been admissible because it was or could have been authenticated. I would just urge the court to consider the fact that that was not the reason why the complaint was not admitted. It was hearsay. There's an analogy about whether the complaint could have been admissible under Rule 806, hearsay exception for business records. That argument was never raised below, and even if it were, this criminal complaint is clearly a document that's produced for litigation, so it wouldn't be admissible under that exception. There was no argument regarding whether the hearsay within hearsay statements were admissible under an exception. So I don't think that the court can look at the record and the arguments that were made to the district court and conclude that the district court abused its discretion for excluding the complaint on the grounds that it did. There's a lot of discussion about Peek v. Handicaps, the non-precedential opinion that suggests that an adverse inference was inappropriate in a case because there was not evidence of a police report, testimony, and a complaint is mentioned in that case. I believe that the landlord's position on, or read of that case, I suppose, is not consistent with what that opinion actually states. What that opinion states is that the record is devoid of any evidence, lists a complaint as one potential form of evidence that could support an adverse inference, and then reverses the fact that the, I think it was a commissioner, decided to draw an adverse inference. There's no discussion about whether a criminal complaint is admissible. It's just listed in a list of forms of evidence that potentially could be.
Can I follow up? You made reference to the exception business records. Isn't it true that a criminal complaint was not made for purposes of this litigation? So that would not in and of itself exclude it, and therefore
I would agree that the criminal complaint was not produced for this litigation, but ultimately that's not a question that the district court passed on because it wasn't an argument that was made to the district court. So for that reason, I think it would be inappropriate to reverse the district court on that basis. In conclusion, I would... I am not arguing that criminal complaints are per se inadmissible. I'm arguing that the criminal complaint in this case was not admissible and the district court acted within its discretion in excluding it. With that, I just ask that the court affirm the district court's decision to dismiss and expunge this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Calla, I see that you do have rebuttal. You're standing up.
Thank you. Judge Slater, yes, Mr. Prentice and I do run across each other nearly daily these days. I saw him yesterday. I'll probably see him this afternoon. A couple things regarding what Mr. Prentice just said. He talked about there being two denials by the tenant of the allegations in the complaint. Those were made through his attorney. He did not deny anything. The real question I have then is, why did we even have a trial?
You know, an answer is signed by the attorney, too. I mean, I don't see the argument, Mr. Kell, that you're making that, well, there wasn't an answer, a written answer, which also would have been signed by an attorney. How is that any difference from the attorney ganging up and, as apparently happened here, and saying, we deny all the allegations?
I mean, because if we get to trial and those same questions are posed to the only person on the attorney's defense side who knows the answers to those questions, and there's a refusal to answer those questions, that suggests to me that the initial answer is a sham answer, that the answer does not reflect the reality of what the client, Mr. Mulakazi, truthfully expressed to his attorney. I mean, if the allegations are denied in his conversation with his attorney, what is the harm in denying them on the record? And to not denying those allegations, those questions on the record, does not incriminate him. In no way. In fact, it bolsters his defense that he is not guilty of what he is being charged of in the criminal complaint. So at the first appearance, when those things are denied, I presume we're going to hear a denial from the defendant when he testifies. And then when he refuses to testify against those questions, that causes me some concern as to, well, what was the basis for the denial by the attorney at the first appearance? Now, how could I have raised this before we get through the trial and find out that there is no response to any of those six questions? That's not something I could have raised at the first appearance or at the trial level. I think it's a sham answer. I mean, I use the word sham in context of Rule 11. I don't think it's legitimate. We should never have proceeded to trial on this case in the first place had we received an accurate, factually accurate answer from the defense. I'm not faulting Mr. Prentice's ethics or anything here. I'm just saying, when I consult with my clients before I sign off on an answer, I send that answer to them and I consult with them to make sure that the factual denials and admissions are accurate. With regards to...
It's hard here because of the overlay of the criminal complaint and law with a civil proceeding.
I guess I don't follow. I mean, if he simply would have denied those six questions that I asked to him, we wouldn't be here. Because I would be faced with having no evidence, really, to weigh against his straight denials. That's what confounds me here, is that these are easy questions to say no.
Is this the first time this has happened? I know this is outside of the record, but I know you practice in this area of the law.
This happens with enough regularity that I get frustrated in not getting cooperation from the law enforcement side of things. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've taken this issue to the Court of Appeals. And nationwide, I haven't been able to find much case law at all regarding... Did we lose Judge Slater?
I think we just did.
No, he's still... Judge Slater, can you hear and see?
I can hear and see.
The TV monitor went blank for a moment
there. Is it back up?
I was not able to find any case. I was not able to find any case law that addresses this specific of an issue, otherwise I would have cited, even from a different jurisdiction. To suggest, as Mr. Prentice does, that the court recognized that an adverse inference could be drawn but concluded against the landlord, I just don't see how the calculus rests that result. I mean, those six questions, if you draw an adverse inference from that, there's only one conclusion to draw, that the tenant did do those things that he was asked of. And if he did, those questions, those answers, exclusively lead to a finding that there was a breach of the lease. With regards to Peak, the reason I cite that case is because it lists a line of documents that could be considered to support an adverse inference, the complaint being one of them. And if, in fact, a complaint is excluded because it's not a business record, because it's hearsay within hearsay, because it's an out-of-court statement, if there's no exception to the hearsay rule, then Peak should not have listed that in the list of documents that would support an adverse inference. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our hearings. We are going to adjourn, and Judge Sleater will call you in about 5 minutes, or we'll see you on Zoom in chambers, okay?
Thank you, sounds good.
Thank you to both of you.